As the United Nations Climate Conference enters its final stretch in Egypt, will the summit end in a climate deal or a dead end? And will the so-called Africa COP deliver for African nations? Also,
promises don't stop the suffering of people. You know, statements made by leaders or governments, they don't stop the rise in global temperatures. Only real action does that.
My conversation with Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate on why she wants wealthy nations to show us the money. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there, I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. For days now, diplomats, activists, and world leaders have been meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for the United Nations Climate Change Conference. They're discussing how to implement a 2015 Global Climate Treaty, also known as the Paris Agreement. The pact, however, contains a controversial question. Should wealthy countries, primarily responsible for decades of carbon pollution, compensate nations hurt most by climate change? And for more on this, we go now to VOA's Middle East correspondent, Heather Murdoch, who is at the climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Heather, thank you so much for being with us. Tell us, what is the latest from the summit? We're hitting the middle of the week now.
People here are already talking about how this summit is going to end. And unfortunately, it's not just a question of how successful it will be. It's a question of it will be successful at all. Some people are warning that there could be backsliding. People are saying that the goal, the 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, that temperature is the goal to limit global warming in future years. And right now, the countries of the world are not on track to reach this limit. And some countries are even talking about saying this goal is not reasonable. However, the G7 and many leaders are still pushing to keep this goal in mind. The other main thing this conference is talking about is how rich countries can and should pay for poorer countries dealing with the climate crisis. And as you know, this year there have been more climate disasters than ever before, and they are expected to increase year by year in coming years. But it's normally the poorest countries in the world, the most vulnerable communities in the world, that experience them the most. And how to hammer out a deal in which what we all agree on morally is true, that richer countries should pay for poorer countries, but how to make it practically happen, it's still not clear if that's going to happen and how it will happen. And there's only a couple days left, so tensions are high.
One of the big sort of side themes of this conference, Heather, has been about leadership and who's showing it. The arrival of Brazilian president-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, that seems to be a big part of this summit, especially now that he's arriving, and also is seen as restoring Brazil's credibility on the issue of climate change, correct?
Yes, this is one event that's happening today that has brought hope to the conference in general. It's quite a positive development in terms of climate change. His predecessor, current President Bolsonaro, is a climate skeptic and has overseen more deforestation in the Amazon rainforest, the biggest rainforest in the world, for years. So the new president-elect is here at COP27, expected to speak shortly, and has declared that he has brought Brazil back to the world stage in terms of climate change prevention. And while he's got a lot of things to overcome at home politically and globally, there is a lot of hope that it is possible that with his leadership, the world might start to slow the deforestation of the Amazon in time to save it.
Well, this seems very similar to what U.S. President Biden, of course, had to do when he came into office. But thank you so much, Heather. Good luck at the summit, but thank you for your reporting. That is VOA's Heather Murdoch. She's our Middle East correspondent. She's at COP27 in Egypt. Well, the G20 summit is underway in Indonesia, and Senegalese President Macky Sall is at the conference in Bali. This is Sall's first visit to a G20 summit. It followed his attendance at COP27, that UN climate meeting in Egypt we're talking about, where he was one of the leading advocates for rich countries to contribute more cash to help Africa adapt to climate change. Meanwhile, a Western-led push to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine dominated Tuesday's G20 summit on the Indonesian island of Bali. Leaders there are representing major economies that are grappling with a dizzying array of issues from hunger to nuclear threats. And on the issue of hunger, a lot of that feeds into the climate change issue. This year's summit at COP, it has been billed the so-called Africa COP. But how much of this meeting in Egypt is about the voices, the interests, and the well-being of Africans? Well, my next two guests are very passionate about the issues of justice and fairness in the fight against climate change. We have with us activist and diplomat Aya Shebi. She joins us from Tunisia. She advocates for Africa's women and youth. And from Johannesburg in South Africa, I'm joined by Marissa Lorenzo. She's a political risk analyst. Ladies, a warm welcome to you both. Aya, I want to start with you. Please give us your assessment of how COP27 is going. What is the summit getting right and what is it getting wrong?
Maybe it's a bit early to say, maybe not, but some national kind of action is taken by some countries like Germany leaving the Energy Charter Treaty. Some leaders are championing very important initiatives like the Adaptation Fund. We see also the rise of philanthropists who are pledging billions to financing. But I think so far there's no show of radical collective action from member states. What I'm excited about maybe is the first youth pavilion at the space happening right now, and also some of the African initiative, the African Climate Risk Facility, the Africa Business Leaders Coalition, and so on. And I think what COP27 is still not getting right is intentionally engaging non-state actors, precisely corporation responsible for what we're discussing today. There was a great speech by the Prime Minister of Barbados who said that gas and oil companies made $200 billion in profit just the last 3 months. How come they're not here to contribute to loss and damage? And she called for a convening with them. But I think the most obvious is that no action on loss and damage remains the biggest concern of activists.
Marissa, what is your take? As Aya said, there are some things to be disappointed about, but some things to be excited about, too.
Well, I think what I've really enjoyed seeing is that African leaders have taken a much stronger stance towards the West in saying that, you know, this energy transition is not entirely fair to place a lot of the responsibility on African countries' shoulders. We saw a little bit of that at COP26, but I think this year we've seen it a lot more. I think the president of Senegal, Macky Sall, has been very important in leading that debate. President Cyril Ramaphosa from South Africa as well has also spoken about the issue of African countries being saddled with more debt. I think it's positive to see leaders being a lot more vocal about this. I suppose in terms of what has been concerning is really that a lot of the commitments made are quite vague. You know, we've seen commitments here and there for several African countries worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. But, you know, we don't necessarily know exactly what each country individually needs, and all of their individual needs are very different. And I think that, you know, we're not also targeting the bigger questions of, okay, we can develop some renewable energy projects, but what about countries that just don't have the distribution infrastructure to actually power their cities? And I think that that's something that's not necessarily being discussed.
A huge part of summits like this is about, of course, who's there, who's not, who has a seat and a voice at the table. And a big part of your platform is about the voices of Africa's women and youth. Please help us understand what is missing from the conversation when we exclude women and when we exclude the young people of Africa.
Well, a long list of missings, you know, with an S. But I think, first of all, representation, as you said, is extremely important. When you look at the family picture, you know, they took at the first day, it can tell you a lot about diversity and representation, especially age and gender. And that picture really reminds us that these people who decide on our climate future are predominantly old men. But I think also youth and women are not a homogeneous group. There are layers of marginalization, being refugee, displaced, with disability, being on the front line of impact of climate change, like women farmers. I think there is definitely a gender lens and intergenerational lens missing from the global discourse. And by missing that, we're missing half of the population. For Africa, we're missing 65% who are under 30 right now in Africa. But I think the good news that I'm seeing, at least for this COP, we have an institutionalized leadership of Africa to engage civil society and non-state actors, including women and youth groups. We see Bokolo Kinawandu, the first African director for Climate Champions. We see a lot of allies who are trying to open up the space. I can attest to our own delegation of Nahla Feminist Collective. We have 7 young women from across the continent who made it to Sharm el-Sheikh. But of course, it's not without challenges, and it's not without sidelining. And even blue zone and green zone and discrimination around accreditation has been a really difficult issue. But, you know, Heidi, young activists are wild, and nothing will stop determined, fearless activists from making their voice heard. And even in Egypt, where protesters are banned, hundreds of climate rallies took place out of COP27, demanding not only, you know, climate justice, but even the freedom of political prisoner Ali Abdel Fattah. So I'm really excited to see how vibrant, how radical, how disrupting African climate activists are at COP27.
Marissa, earlier I talked about the issue of leadership. And we're seeing a lot of our African leaders on the world stage telling wealthier nations, of course, that it is their responsibility to pay up for the loss and damage that they have largely caused, which is all fine and well. What I am curious about is our African leaders themselves, the talk they give on the international stage, are they by and large walking that talk at home in terms of protecting vulnerable communities from the impacts of climate change?
I think it's important to remember here that certainly a lot of these leaders do have a lot of struggles back home. There are always issues around sometimes money that is meant to go towards helping communities that are affected by climate change not always going to the right place. But I think that even with having some of these issues back home, it's still very fair of these African leaders to go to the West and to say that, you know, they do have a big role. They have played a very big role in, you know, exacerbating climate change, and this has had a major impact mostly on African countries. I don't think that just, you know, because perhaps there are challenges back home, that they don't necessarily have the room or the space to bring these issues forward and discuss it. I think as well that, you know, what we really have to see is that as a whole, African countries, most of them are just bearing the brunt and the responsibility of taking this energy transition forward. But these are countries that are not industrialized. These are countries that do have gas reserves that could be exploited for better economic growth. They have all of this at their disposal, and suddenly they're being told not to use it by countries that have used fossil fuels to industrialize and to become wealthy and also take resources from Africa. And I think that that's an important debate that shouldn't be lost no matter what challenges are back home.
Aya, there are so many questions coming out of that answer that I want to talk to you about, but I want to get to this idea first. Are our expectations high enough of our own leaders to walk the talk at home when it comes to protecting vulnerable communities, making sure that money intended to tackle climate change gets to those communities? What's your take?
I mean, if we were to talk about education or health or development, we can have a lot to say, honestly, about money not reaching the people who need it the most. And that could be a different conversation. But, you know, Heidi, it is astonishing, actually, that we actually do not have the finances on this one as African nations. The world needs $5 trillion in annual climate finance by 2030. The continent gets only 5.5% of this financing. And we need up to $2.5 trillion of climate finance for this decade to implement the Paris Agreement. So, I mean, this has been said, of course, we need robust accountability mechanisms once we mobilize the needed resources, which we don't have for now. But I think partnership with civil society is often the best way to watchdog transparency and accountability on such funding.
And I do want to ask you, Aya, about that second part of what Marissa was talking about, because this was my question too, about the debate around the West's so-called hypocrisy, as many critics call it, saying that, you know, the wealthy nations industrialized on fossil fuels. Africa has a lot of fossil fuels at its disposal. Countries have large natural gas reserves. Should Africa not have the right to develop and develop at the same pace using their fossil fuels like the West did?
Well, I mean, first, I think on the global stage, we need to be bolder to say to wealthy countries that we're not begging you. You owe us. You contribute the most to emissions. You industrialize by extracting Africa's wealth, and you need to pay. You must pay. But I don't think we should industrialize on fossil fuel. And the irony is that COP has been a place to push African countries to use fossil fuel and gas instead of paying us loss and damage to transition to renewable. I think we need to recognize that historically, fossil fuel has not been meeting the needs of African people. It was used to, you know, build trains and routes and ships and airlines and the infrastructure to nourish European economies. It was not built to prosper our people in the first place. So why continue to build what is extracting our wealth, health, and future? I think we have the choice for renewable electricity, for green hydrogen, for wind and solar energy, and even for job creation to our very young population. Studies show now that more jobs can be created in renewable than the current gas-based strategies in our country. So I do hope, despite our hardships and the inequality in the global conversation in climate crisis, that our African leaders would do things differently.
Marissa, very briefly here, do you see that disconnect between African activists and perhaps African leaders on this issue of using fossil fuels to develop and what Africa should and shouldn't do on that score?
Yes, absolutely. There's this disconnect between activists advocating, you know, for renewable energy options and governments, many governments saying, you know, that actually they should still be allowed to use gas. But I think something else that's important to keep in mind is that not all African countries are in agreement on the way forward. You know, Africa's not one homogenous entity. It's a very large landmass. It's got, you know, 54 countries, and every president has a kind of different view of the direction that its country should take. And I think what we've also seen come out of COP27 is these different viewpoints being a lot more entrenched. You know, we had Kenya several months before COP saying that actually we shouldn't use fossil fuels. We've got Namibia, which is really pushing the green hydrogen agenda because of its own potential. We've got Mozambique saying that actually can we not just use gas as a transition fuel? I think that these debates and these conflicting views are going to continue to shape the debate around the energy transition. And I suppose the hope is really that African countries can start to perhaps show more of a unified, united front towards the West to say that they have to face the role that they played in it, and that perhaps going forward, the future of development and industrialization in most of Africa is really going to be based on a balance between using the fossil fuels that we do have and then harnessing the renewable energy that comes from that. Because I think at the end of the day, we have to remember that renewables at the moment don't have enough baseload capacity. Using more renewables means using more minerals, which means more mining, which causes huge environmental degradation. And that will happen in Africa. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of different elements and a lot of different facets to this debate. And
indeed,
hopefully that will become a lot more sophisticated going forward.
An interesting conversation indeed. Ladies, thank you so much for joining me. Aya Shebi and Marissa Lorenzo, I do thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Well, still to come here on Straight Talk Africa, my conversation with Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate on what she believes a real Africa COP should look like. We'll hear from her after the break. We'll be right back. You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Vanessa Nakate is one of the most famous climate activists in the world. The young Ugandan often comes across as soft-spoken, but when it comes to the climate fight, she's definitely not afraid to make her voice heard. Nakate, a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, says climate change is about people. And I spoke with her in New York recently about her activism and why she advocates for what she calls forgotten communities.
My name is Vanessa Nakate. I'm 25. I'm a climate justice activist from Uganda. And I am working to change a warming planet into a more sustainable, a more healthy, and a more cleaner planet for all of us.
Vanessa, what drew you to the world of activism? And then what made you take on the climate crisis?
My very first involvement was really in 2018. That's when I started to carry out research about the challenges that the people in my country, Ghana, were facing. And at that point, I found out that climate change was one of those challenges. We do study about climate change in school. Most of the students have, you know, read about it in geography class, but it doesn't carry like the reality of what is happening. So you study it, you do the exams, and you go to the next class. So I didn't really understand the impact of climate change while in school. But in my research, I got to see the impacts, and I got to understand the landslides that were happening, you know, in areas like Bududa, Bundibugyo, the flooding, the droughts that were impacting very many people in Uganda. That is what really triggered me to start asking questions and doing more research about what causes climate change and why is it that people are suffering right now. And in that, I decided I had to do something about it. And being inspired by Greta Thunberg from Sweden, I started to strike for the climate.
I've read that you've said that you don't want to be the go-to African voice on this issue, on climate change. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I have had experiences where I am called the voice of the African continent when it comes to climate activism, and that is not something that I want to be called, because I think it's very problematic in a way, because it erases the voices of other activists that are doing incredible work. I'm not the first activist on the African continent or even the first activist in Uganda. There have been people that have been organizing and mobilizing for years, and I just happened to also join this, you know, movement that was already there of different organizers. So when I am, you know, called a representative or something like that, it erases the work of other activists. And the experiences that I see in Uganda, for example, with the landslides and the floods, may not be the experiences that another activist sees in their country. And I may carry a statistic of what is happening in Kenya or in South Africa, but I may not carry the experience. And that's why there is a need for those stories in those communities to tell, you know, to have their own platforms, to be amplified, and for people to know that the climate movement is more than one face or two faces. It's a whole global movement with millions of activists that are organizing and mobilizing and, you know, transforming their communities. And this is something that I say so many times. Every activist has a story to tell, and every story has a solution to give, and every solution has a life to change.
So now you are UNICEF's newest Goodwill Ambassador. What do you plan to do with this role, and what do you think you are uniquely positioned to accomplish?
It's important for me to acknowledge that, you know, incredible work has already been done through different people that have worked with UNICEF. And this is me just adding, you know, adding my voice as well to this work and also my platform. And basing on a visit that I recently made in Turkana, one of the regions that are being impacted by the drought in the Horn of Africa, and the mothers and the children that I met that are suffering from malnutrition, these are the stories that really need to be heard and listened to. And I really hope that in this role as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, I get to bring these stories, you know, these communities, these children, and just tell what is happening and how the food crisis is really exacerbating malnutrition and how children and women are suffering the most. And hopefully we can get the solutions that are needed for these communities.
You talk about COP27 for the first time on African soil. Do you see this as an opportunity for voices that have previously not been heard or represented?
So for me personally, what will make this an African COP goes beyond it happening on African soil, but actually having African communities represented and telling their stories, telling their experiences, and talking about, you know, the solutions that work for their communities. So I believe, you know, this is an opportunity to really highlight the impacts of the climate crisis on the African continent. It's an opportunity to highlight how Africa is not responsible for this crisis, and yet people are suffering. It's an opportunity to highlight the solutions that are much needed for the African continent, and also the demands on climate finance. We know $100 billion was promised, but it was never delivered. It has not yet been delivered. And, you know, promises don't stop the suffering of people. You know, statements made by leaders or governments, they don't stop the rise in global temperatures. Only real action does that. And we hope that at this COP27, we see real action. We see that gap that has always been there between words and actions is actually bridged with real action, with real money put in place for mitigation, for adaptation, and for loss and damage.
You say that African countries are on the front lines of the climate crisis, and I've read you said that they're not in the headlines or on the front pages of newspapers or in the media. What kind of stories do you think we need to see around the climate crisis and the impact on communities, especially in Africa?
Well, I think we need to see the stories of those on the front lines, the stories of those that, you know, that are suffering the worst impacts of climate change right now. We need to see the stories of those who know that climate change is happening right now, who have experienced it right now. Not stories of people who think climate change is coming in the future and we have to prepare for it. So, I mean, it goes back to the communities, the people that are organizing across Africa, you know, Uganda, South Africa, Nigeria. There are different activists that are organizing and talking about the issues happening in their communities, and they really deserve these platforms. They deserve to be amplified, and media has a huge responsibility to talk about the climate crisis. But it has a much bigger responsibility to cover the climate crisis in the communities that are on the front lines. Yes, we are, you know, we are facing the same storm, but we are in different boats. It's high time media really covers the boats that are already sinking or the boats that are already worn out because of the climate crisis.
Same storm, different boats. Vanessa Nakate there, what an impressive young woman. Well, do let me know what you think about the things she just spoke about and about the climate change debate. You can tweet us at VOA Straight Talk. And that's where we wrap things up today on this edition of Straight Talk Africa. A huge thank you to all my guests, to all our affiliates carrying the show across the African continent, and of course to you, our audience, for giving us your time on radio, television, and for streaming with us online. Do take care. Until next time, goodbye.